Okay, let's dive right in. There's this statistic floating around. By next year, 2025, the average family deductible could be over $3,500.
Wow. Yeah, that's a big number.
It really is. It hits your wallet directly. So the big question we're tackling today is how do we, get smarter about navigating this whole changing healthcare cost thing?
Well, it's interesting because as more of that financial weight shifts to individuals, we've actually seen a lot of innovation. New ways to finance healthcare have popped up.
Exactly. And that's what this deep dive is all about. We're going to try and make sense of consumer-driven healthcare, those tax-advantaged accounts, HSAs, FSAs, HRAs, all that alphabet soup.
Yeah.
We'll even touch on the compliance side, the rules you need to know. And our insights today, they're pulled from a pretty comprehensive course, actually, one designed for benefits pros. So you're getting a bit of an inside track.
And the bottom line for you, the listener, is that understanding this stuff, it's not just about saving a few bucks here and there. It can really change how you manage your healthcare finances. We're talking potential for significant savings, better access to care. It's directly tied to your financial well-being.
So our mission, if you will, for this deep dive, cut through the jargon, pull out the key insights you need to understand these options without feeling totally overwhelmed.
Like you need a PhD in finance just to go to the doctor.
Exactly. Think of this as your shortcut, your express lane to getting informed.
Okay, so maybe we should start with, like, how did we even get here? Why are these accounts suddenly so important? It wasn't always like this.
That's a great point. If you rewind, say, 25 years, the picture was really different. Lots of employers had defined benefit plans.
Right, the old pension-style health benefits.
Yeah, the benefit was just there, provided. But
Oh.
now, most employers have shifted. It's defined contribution.
Meaning the employer says, here's X amount of dollars, and
And the rest, the overall cost risk, that's increasingly landing on you, the employee. I mean, that's the fundamental shift, isn't it? Who carries the financial risk?
absolutely. And that shift, that cost pressure on employees really opened the door for these financing revolutions, you could call them.
Revolutions, I like that.
Well, deductibles started climbing. So first you saw FSAs pop up, flexible spending accounts, and MERPs, medical expense reimbursement plans, ways to use pre-tax money for those new costs.
Oh, okay, so that helped a bit.
It did. Then around 2000, HRAs arrived on the scene. Health reimbursement arrangements. These were employer funded. Another tool.
But here's the interesting thing, right? HRAs helped employers manage costs, sure. But did they really change how we use healthcare?
Maybe not fundamentally. It could still feel a bit like, house money.
Exactly. So then, late 2003, the game changer arrives, the HSA, Health Savings
Oh,
Account.
yes, the HSA.
This was pivotal. The idea was, okay, let's link these health plans that have higher deductibles, the HDHPs, with your own savings
Yeah,
account.
you have a really nice carrot. Tax advantages, serious tax advantages.
Right, to try and encourage consumerism, make you think a bit more directly about the cost because it's, well, partly your saved money.
And it's not just about making you pinch pennies. The idea is also empowering you,
Yeah.
making more informed choices when you're the one managing the dollars
Yeah.
directly.
Things keep evolving. I mean, look at the legislation. We had the ACA back in 2010,
Big changes there.
then the CARES Act in 2020 that was huge for making over-the-counter meds eligible again for these accounts.
That was a welcome change for a lot of people.
Huh.
Suddenly, you could use your FSA or HSA for Tylenol, allergy meds.
Yeah. And now, looking ahead to 2025, there's IRS Notice 2024-75. It actually expands what preventive care can be covered by those high deductible plans before you hit the deductible.
Oh, interesting. Like what?
Things like over-the-counter contraceptives, certain breast cancer screenings, it broadens that pre-deductible coverage.
So you see this continuous sort of tweaking, right? Trying to refine these models, balance the cost control with making sure people get necessary care.
Definitely. Okay, so that's the backdrop, the shifting landscape. Now let's get into the nuts and bolts. Let's decode some of this terminology, the CDHC CAST, as they sometimes call it.
Yeah, the jargon can be a real barrier. Understanding the basic terms is step one.
Totally. Let's start with a cafeteria plan. Sounds delicious, but what is it really?
Yeah, not quite lunch. It's basically a formal written plan from your employer that lets you choose certain benefits and pay for them with pre-tax dollars.
So money comes out of your paycheck before taxes are taken out.
Exactly. For things like health insurance premiums, maybe contributions to your FSA or HSA, it saves you money on income tax and usually FICA taxes too. Saves your employer money as well.
Okay, that makes sense. Pre-tax benefits. What about this consumer corridor?
Think of that as your initial skin in the game. your deductible, maybe some co-pays, the amount you have to pay out of pocket before the insurance plan starts paying the bigger share.
Ah, so it's that first part you're responsible for.
Right. And the theory is, having that corridor makes you a more conscious shopper for healthcare services. Might encourage you to ask about prices, look for more cost-effective options.
Which ties right back into that core idea of CDHC consumer-driven healthcare. Your financial stake influences your choices.
Precisely.
Okay, now, permitted insurance and permitted coverage. These sound specific. What's the deal here, especially if you have an HSA?
Yeah, this is important for HSA eligibility. Permitted insurance usually refers to specific types of supplemental policies, like for a particular disease, say, cancer insurance, or policies that pay a fixed amount per day if you're hospitalized.
Okay.
Permitted coverage is typically for things like dental, vision, disability, long-term care insurance. The key point is, you can have these types of insurance or coverage alongside your HSA qualifying health plan without messing up your ability to contribute to the HSA.
Ah, so there are exceptions to the rule that you can't have other health coverage before meeting your main plan's deductible.
Exactly. The IRS specifically carved these out.
Yeah.
So you can have, say, separate vision insurance and still contribute to your HSA.
Got it. Okay, what about a dual-use HRA?
That's an interesting one. It's an HRA employer-funded, remember, that's designed to be used for one set of expenses before you retire, like general medical costs, and then switch to covering different expenses after you retire, maybe long-term care premiums.
Flexible. And a suspended HRA.
That's a neat trick. If you have an HRA but then become eligible for an HSA, say you switch to a QHDHP, you can ask your employer to essentially suspend your HRA.
Why would you do that?
Because having access to regular HRA funds would normally disqualify you from contributing to an HSA. Suspending it pauses that HRA coverage, lets you contribute to your HSA, and you might be able to reactivate the HRA later if things change again.
Clever workaround. Okay, then, limited purpose plans, often called DV.
All right, for dental and vision. These are typically FSAs or sometimes HRAs that are restricted only to billing for dental and vision expenses.
And why are these useful with an HSA?
Because, like permitted coverage, they don't count as disqualifying other health coverage. So you can have your HSA for general medical stuff and a separate limited purpose FSA just for your glasses and dental cleanings, getting tax advantages on both.
Makes sense. Okay, quick hits on a few more we've touched on. Qualified High Deductible Health Plan, QHDHP.
That's the specific type of insurance plan, meeting federal deductible and out-of-pocket limits, that you absolutely must have to contribute to an HSA, your entry ticket.
Healthcare reimbursement arrangement, HRA.
Employer-funded account. Lots of flexibility for the employer in how it's designed and what it covers. Not your money, technically. Belongs to the employer until reimbursed.
And the star? Healthcare savings account, HSA.
Individual account. Your money, triple tax advantage, portable. But stricter rules on who can contribute tied to that QHDHP.
Defined contribution plans back to the employer side.
Yep, just the employer setting a fixed contribution amount for benefits, shifting risk, controlling their costs.
Internal Revenue Code Section 213, IRC Section 213 sounds official.
It is. That's the part of the tax code that defines what actually counts as a qualified medical expense. It's the master list for what you can use your HSA, FSA, or HRA money for tax-free.
The rule book for spending. And finally, stacking.
That's the strategy piece. We'll get into more detail on combining these different accounts, like an HSA and an LPFSA, to maximize coverage and tax savings.
Okay, wow. That's quite the cast of characters. A lot to keep straight.
It is, but understanding these basics really unlocks the ability to use them effectively. It's the foundation.
Absolutely. Okay, foundation laid. Now let's really zoom in on the health savings account, the HSA. What exactly is an HSA, let's say, for 2025, in simple terms?
Okay, simply put, based on the IRS rules, specifically Section 223, an HSA is your own personal savings account. It's designed purely to help you pay for qualified healthcare costs.
Introduced back in 2003, you said?
That's right. And the absolute key, the non-negotiable part, is that to open and contribute, you must be covered by one of those qualified high-deductible health plans, a QHDHP. It's the gateway.
Right. The QHDHP is a ticket. So what are the specific numbers for a QHDHP in 2025? What makes a plan qualified?
Good question. For 2025, the feds dictate two main things. First, the minimum deductible. The plan has to have a deductible of at least $1,650 if it's just for you, single coverage.
Okay.
And at least $3,300 for family coverage. That's the floor.
Got it. Minimum deductible. What else?
Second, there's a cap on your total out-of-pocket expenses for in-network services. For 2025, the maximum you can be required to pay is $8,300 for single coverage.
Okay.
and $16,600 for family coverage. That includes your deductible, copays, coinsurance. It's your financial safety net within the plan.
So minimum deductible, maximum out-of-pocket, those are the plan's features. Now, who specifically can actually open and crucially contribute to an HSA in 2025? What are the eligibility rules for me?
Right. It breaks down into three distinct parts, which can be confusing. Let's clarify. First, eligibility to open an HSA.
Okay, step one.
To open the account, you need to meet several conditions at that time. One, be covered by a QHDHP. Two, have no other health coverage that pays before you meet that QHDHP deductible, with those exceptions we mentioned, like specific permitted insurance or coverage like dental vision.
No other first dollar coverage, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah. Three, you cannot be enrolled in Medicare, any part of it.
Okay, no Medicare.
And four, you cannot be claimed as a dependent on someone else's tax return.
That makes sense. So QHDHP, no conflicting coverage, not on Medicare, not a dependent. That lets you open the account. What's part two?
Part two is eligibility to contribute. This is where it gets dynamic.
Oh.
To put money into your HSA, you have to meet all those opening requirements, QHDHP, no other coverage, et cetera, on a monthly basis.
Yeah.
Specifically on the first day of the month.
So eligibility isn't just a one-time check. It's ongoing.
For contributions, yes. Your situation on the 1st of February determines if you can contribute for February. Same for March, April, and so on. Even if you, say, dump the whole year's contribution in January, you technically need to remain eligible month by month.
Okay, that's a critical point. Eligibility to contribute can change. What's the third piece of eligibility then?
This is the good part. Eligibility to reimburse yourself or pay for expenses from the HSA.
Using the money that's already in there.
Precisely. Once the account is established and has funds, you can always use that money to pay for qualified medical expenses. It doesn't matter if you later lose your QHDHP coverage or get Medicare or get other insurance. The money is yours for healthcare, period.
Okay. So opening and contributing have strict rules tied to your current insurance. But using the money for health costs, that's always allowed once the account's open and funded.
You got it. Think of it like a timeline. Your ability to add money waxes and wanes with your insurance situation.
Right. Like I start a new job, maybe get a traditional PPO plan.
Exactly. Your contribution window might close temporarily.
Yeah.
Or maybe your spouse signs up for their work's general purpose FSA.
That could stop my contributions too?
Yes, often it does, because that FSA could potentially pay for your medical bills before your deductible is met. But the money already in your HSA, still yours. Your ability to take money out for a doctor's visit or prescription, always there, as long as there's a balance.
That clears up a lot. I can see how people get tangled up differentiating contribution rules from reimbursement rules.
It's a common point of confusion. Life changes happen. Maybe you enroll in Medicare Part A when you turn 65. Contributions stop then too. But the funds remain available for reimbursement.
Okay, crystal clear. So let's talk about those contributions. What are the limits for 2025? How much can I actually put in?
For 2025, the maximum contribution is $4,150 if you have self-only QHDHP coverage.
$4,150 for individual.
Right. And if you have family coverage under QHDHP, the limit is
$8,300. $8,300 for family. Okay. And wasn't there something about being older, a catch-up?
Yes. If you are age 55 or older by the end of the year, you can contribute an additional $1,000. This is a catch-up contribution.
So someone 55 plus with family coverage could put in $9,300? $8,300 plus $1,000?
Exactly. And if both spouses are 55 plus and have family coverage, they could each potentially contribute $1,000 extra, but usually into separate HSAs unless certain conditions are met. But the $1,000 is per person age 55 or older.
That's a nice boost for people closer to retirement. Now, I remember reading about something called the last month rule. How does that work? It sounded kind of helpful.
Yes, the last month rule. It can be a fantastic benefit, especially if you gain HSA eligibility late in the calendar year.
Okay.
The rule says, if you are HSA eligible on December 1st of a given year.
Just need to be eligible on that one day, December 1st.
That's the trigger. If you meet the criteria on December 1st, you're allowed to contribute the full maximum annual amount for that entire year, even if you only became eligible in, say, November or December.
Whoa. Seriously. So start a job with a QHDHP on December 1st, and I can put in the full $4,150 or $8,300 for that year.
That's the power of the last month rule. But well, there's always a but with taxes,
exactly.
Right?
What's the catch?
It comes with something called the testing period. If you use the last month rule to make that full contribution, you must remain HSA eligible for the entire following calendar year.
The whole next year, January 1st through December 31st.
Yep, all 12 months of the next year. That's the testing period. If you fail that test, meaning you lose your HSA eligibility sometime during that following year.
Like, I switched jobs mid-year to a non-QHDHP plan.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Then the portion of your contribution that you only got to make because of the last month rule, basically the prorated amount for the months you weren't eligible in the first year, becomes taxable income. And you get hit with an additional 10% penalty tax on that amount.
Ouch. So great opportunity, but you got to stick with the qualifying plan for a while longer. Good to know.
What about moving money into an HSA from, say, an IRA? Is that possible? Yes, there's a provision for that. IRS Notice 2008-51 allows for a one-time direct trustee-to-trustee transfer from a traditional IRA or Roth IRA into an HSA.
One time only. Per lifetime?
Per lifetime, yes. It can also come from an inactive SEP or simple IRA, but not an ongoing one.
And how much can you transfer?
The amount you transfer counts towards your maximum HSA contribution limit for the year you do the transfer. So it's not extra contribution room. It just changes the source of the funds for that year.
Okay, so it's a way to fund it using existing retirement money, but it uses up your annual HSA limit.
Got it. Now, big question. Who actually owns the HSA? If my employer sets it up or contributes, is it theirs?
Absolutely not. This is one of the best features. The HSA is owned 100% by you, the individual. It's your personal account.
So if I leave my job?
It goes with you. It's completely portable. Doesn't matter if you change jobs, change health insurance, retire. The account and the money in it are yours.
And the money just stays there if I don't use it.
Yes. It rolls over year after year. There's no use it or lose it deadline like with traditional FSAs. And can it grow? Like investments.
Definitely. Most HSA providers offer investment options, similar to a 401k or IRA. You can invest your HSA balance, and any earnings or growth on those investments are also tax-free, as long as you eventually use the money for qualified medical expenses.
Wow. So portable, rolls over, potential tax-free investment growth. That really makes it more than just a healthcare spending account.
It makes it a powerful long-term savings and investment vehicle, especially for future healthcare costs. That individual ownership is key.
Okay, so we have this portable account. Maybe it's growing. What exactly can I use that money for? What counts as an eligible medical expense under good old IRC Section 213?
The list is pretty broad, actually. It covers the obvious things. Doctor visits, specialist copays, prescription drugs, hospital stays.
Standard medical stuff.
Right. But also dental care cleanings, fillings, orthodontics, vision care exams, glasses, contacts, mental health therapy and counseling, even things like acupuncture or chiropractic care if recommended by a doctor for a specific condition.
Okay, pretty comprehensive. What else?
Long-term care expenses and even premiums for qualified long-term care insurance. If you lose your job and go on COBRA, you can pay those COBRA premiums from your HSA.
Oh, that's useful.
And for retirees, you can use HSA funds to pay premiums for Medicare Part A, Part B, and Part D, or a Medicare Advantage Part C plan, but not for supplemental Medigap premiums, interestingly.
Good distinction. What about family?
You can use your HSA money for qualified expenses incurred by yourself, your spouse, and any dependents you claim on your tax return, even if they aren't covered by your QHDHP.
So my spouse could be on their own plan, but I can use my HSA for their dentist bill.
As long as it's a qualified expense, yes. And one more surprise for some people. Qualified medical services received outside the United States can often be paid for with HSA funds, too.
Wow, okay. That covers a lot of ground. Now, for people who are employed, what's the absolute smartest way, tax-wise, to get money into that HSA?
Hands down, the best way is through payroll deduction via your employer's Section 125 cafeteria plan, if they offer it.
Why is that the best?
Because the money comes out of your paycheck before federal income tax, before state income tax in most states, and this is the big one, before FICA taxes are calculated.
FICA, that's Social Security and Medicare taxes.
That's right. You avoid paying that 7.65% tax on the money you contribute via cafeteria plan, and your employer also saves their matching 7.65% FICA tax. It's a win-win.
So it's like getting an immediate 7.65% bonus on your contributions on top of the income tax savings.
Essentially, yes. That's why it's often called the triple tax advantage. Tax-free contributions, including FICA savings via cafeteria plan, tax-free growth, and tax-free withdrawals for qualified expenses.
Okay, contributing through the cafeteria plan is clearly the way to go if possible. Now, reimbursement timing. Let's say I paid a big medical bill out of pocket 3 years ago before I really understood my HSA. Can I still reimburse myself today for my HSA for that old bill?
Yes, absolutely. This is another fantastic feature of HSAs. Unlike FSAs, there is no time limit for reimbursing yourself for a qualified medical expense.
No deadline. None at all.
Nope. As long as the expense was incurred after you established your HSA, and it was a qualified expense at that time, you can reimburse yourself years, even decades later.
Wow. So if I find a shoebox full of old medical receipts from 5 years ago...
And you had your HSA established back then, and you have the funds now, you can pay yourself back tax-free for those expenses. The crucial thing, though, is record-keeping.
Gotta have proof.
You need to be able to prove, if the IRS ever asks, that the reimbursement was for a legitimate, qualified medical expense that you paid out of pocket and occurred after the HSA was set up. Keep those receipts or EOBs.
Good advice. Okay, let's talk taxes again when you take money out. We know it's tax-free for qualified medical stuff. What if you use it for something else, like a vacation?
Okay, if you take a non-qualified distribution, use the money for something other than a verified medical expense, and you are under age 65, you'll owe regular income tax on the amount withdrawn, PLUS, a hefty 20% additional tax penalty.
20% penalty. Ouch.
Yeah, they really want you to use it for health care before 65. However, that penalty is waived if the withdrawal happens after you become disabled or after you die.
Okay. What about after age 65, if I use it for non-medical things then?
After 65, the rules relax a bit. If you use the funds for non-qualified expenses, you still owe regular income tax on the withdrawal, just like you would pulling money from a traditional 401k or IRA. But the 20% penalty, that goes away.
So after 65, it basically becomes like a regular retirement account for non-medical spending, just subject to income tax.
Exactly, which adds incredible flexibility for retirement planning. It's best used for healthcare tax-free, but you have that taxable option for anything else after 65 without penalty.
That's really good to know. Now, what if my employer contributes to my HSA? Are there specific rules they have to follow?
Yes, a couple of main things. If the employer contributions are made through that Section 125 cafeteria plan.
The pre-tax payroll deduction route.
Right. Then they mainly just need to follow the standard non-discrimination rules that apply to all cafeteria plans. Basically, the plan can't unfairly favor the highly paid employees over rank-and-file workers.
Okay, standard stuff for benefits plans. What if they contribute outside of a cafeteria plan? Just give money directly to employee HSAs.
Then they generally fall under what are called comparability rules. This usually means if they contribute for one employee, they have to make comparable contributions to all similarly situated employees who are eligible for an HSA.
So same amount or same formula for everyone in the same group?
Generally, yes. There needs to be consistency. However, there's a notable exception related to wellness programs.
Wellness incentives. Can employers tie HSA contributions to participating in, say, a health screening or something?
Yes. Even under comparability rules outside a cafeteria plan, there's an exception allowing employers to make larger HSA contributions to employees who participate in a bona fide wellness program compared to those who don't.
Interesting. So they can reward participation?
They can, within limits. The extra contribution for participants has to be available to all similarly situated employees in the program, and the differential often can't exceed certain thresholds tied to plan deductibles. And of course, the wellness program itself has to comply with other laws like IPAA and the ADA.
Makes sense. Lots of rules there. Okay, we touched on retirement. Just to really hammer it home, why is the HSA considered such a powerful tool for retirement savings specifically?
It really comes down to that unique triple tax advantage we keep mentioning. One, contributions go in tax-free, potentially avoiding income and FICA taxes. Two, any growth from investing the funds inside the HSA is tax-free. Three, withdrawals for qualified medical expenses, which can be significant in retirement, are completely tax-free.
No other retirement account has that exact combination, right?
Correct. 401ks and traditional IRAs are usually tax-deferred, taxed on withdrawal. Roth accounts are tax-free on withdrawal, but contributions aren't deductible. The HSA gets you benefits at all three stages for healthcare spending. And then that post-65 flexibility for non-medical expenses, albeit taxable, just adds another layer. It's incredibly potent.
Okay. Great explanation. Now, let's tackle a listener question. This comes from an HR manager. If our company contributes to employee HSAs, does that mean the HSAs become subject to ERISA?
That's the big employee benefits law, right?
Okay.
Big compliance headaches if it applies.
That's a fantastic and very practical question for employers. The general answer is usually no, if the employer structures it correctly.
Okay, what's the key?
The Department of Labor provides an ERISA safe harbor for employer involvement with HSAs. If the employer meets all six conditions of this safe harbor, the HSAs generally won't be considered ERISA plans.
Six conditions. What are they, broadly?
Broadly, things like
employee participation must be completely voluntary. The employer can't limit the employee's ability to move their HSA funds to a different HSA vendor. The employer can't impose conditions on using HSA funds. They can't make investment decisions for the employee. They can't represent that the HSA is an employer-sponsored plan. And their involvement must be limited mainly to administrative tasks like payroll deductions and selecting vendors employees can use but aren't required to use.
So keep it voluntary, maintain employee control and portability, don't endorse it as our plan.
That's the gist. If they stick within those boundaries, they can usually contribute without triggering ERISA's complex requirements for those accounts.
Very helpful for any employers listening. And just to circle back on wellness incentives with HSAs, generally okay, even outside a cafeteria plan, as long as they follow those specific wellness program exception rules.
Yes, exactly. Permissible, but need to navigate the comparability rules and the specific wellness exception carefully, ensuring fairness and compliance with other regulations.
Okay, fantastic deep dive on HSAs themselves. Now let's talk strategy. This idea of stacking accounts. How do you combine an HSA with other things like FSAs or HRAs to really maximize your coverage and tax savings?
Right. Stacking is where things get really strategic. It's about layering these different tools. And it's important to think about this in light of the 2025 numbers, the new HSA limits, the FSA carryover rules might have changed slightly, those QHDHP deductible and out-of-pocket figures we discussed. All that feeds into the strategy.
Okay, so what's a common powerful stack? You mentioned the power couple earlier.
Yes, the classic power couple is pairing your HSA with a limited purpose FSA or LPFSA.
A dental and vision one.
Exactly. So the HSA is your main engine. You fund it as much as possible for general medical costs, future needs, maybe investments, getting that triple tax advantage.
Okay.
Simultaneously, you use the LPFSA specifically for those predictable, planned dental and vision expenses, glasses, contacts, dental cleanings, maybe braces.
And the LPFSA funds are also pre-tax.
Yes. So in 2025, you could potentially put, so $4,150 into your HSA pre-tax, or maybe even avoiding FICA tax via cafeteria plan.
Right.
And maybe contribute up to the LPFSA limit, which was $3,200 for 2024, likely similar for 2025, also pre-tax. That's a lot of tax advantage money working for you.
So you're segmenting your spending HSA for medical, LPFSA for dental vision, and getting tax breaks on both streams.
Precisely. It keeps everything clean, avoids violating HSA rules, and maximizes your tax savings. The LPFSA is use it or lose it generally, though there might be carryover grace periods. So you estimate those DV costs. The HSA just keeps rolling over and growing.
Makes sense. Any practical tips for making that HSA plus LPFSA combo work smoothly?
Yeah, a couple of things. Try to project your dental and vision costs for the year so you don't overfund the LPFSA.
Yeah.
Prioritize maxing out the HSA if you can, since that's the long-term powerhouse. Keep receipts, especially differentiating between medical and DV.
Good point on receipts.
And maybe consider setting up automatic payments from the LPFSA for recurring things like contact lens orders, if your provider allows it.
Yeah.
And maybe use separate debit cards if you get them, one clearly marked HSA, one LPFSA.
Two cards. Good idea. Avoids mix-ups at the pharmacy or dentist. Okay, what other stacking combinations are out there?
Well, you could get pretty comprehensive. We could call it the complete stack. Imagine a family. Maybe one spouse has the HSA plus LPFSA through their job.
Uh-huh.
The other spouse might be self-employed or work for a small company offering an ICHRA, an individual coverage HRA. That ICHRA could reimburse premiums for their individual health plan. So you've got multiple tax advantage tools covering different family members and types of costs.
Okay, covering more bases. Any other common pairings?
Another one is HSA plus a post-deductible FSA or PDFSA.
Post-deductible, how does that work?
With this strategy, you use your HSA funds first to cover your medical costs up until you meet the minimum statutory deductible for your QHDHP, that $1,650 single $3,300 family for 2025.
Okay, HSA pays for us up to that federal minimum.
Right. Then for expenses incurred after you've met that minimum statutory deductible, but maybe before you meet your actual plan's full deductible, if it's higher, you could potentially use funds from the post-deductible FSA.
So the PDFSA kicks in later to cover that gap between the minimum required deductible and your actual plan deductible.
Exactly. The goal here is to preserve more of your HSA funds for the long term, letting the PDFSA handle some of that intermediate deductible spending. It's a bit more complex to track, though.
Seems like it. Okay, you also hinted at some new combination opportunities for 2025. What's exciting on the horizon?
Two things stand out. First, the accepted benefit HRA or EBHRA paired with an HSA.
EBHRA, that's different from a regular HRA.
Yes, it's designed to reimburse premiums for things other than comprehensive health insurance, like dental, vision, short-term medical, maybe COBRA. and the limit went up for 2025 to $1,950.
So how does it pair with an HSA?
An employee could use the EBHRA funds, employer provided, to pay their dental insurance premium, for example, while still contributing to and using their HSA for their main medical expenses under their QHDHP. It adds another layer of employer-funded help without messing up the HSA.
Interesting. What's the second new opportunity?
Direct primary care, or DPC, combined with an HSA.
DPC? Like those clinics where you pay a monthly fee for unlimited primary care?
Exactly. For a while, there was uncertainty about whether paying that DPC fee counted as other health coverage that would disqualify you from an HSA. But recent IRS guidance clarified things.
And what did it say?
It basically said that a DPC membership fee, structured correctly, is considered payment for medical care under Section 213, not disqualifying health insurance. So you can pay your DPC monthly fee and still contribute to your HSA.
Oh, that's huge. So you can have that consistent primary care access via DPC and use your HSA for specialists, prescriptions, emergencies, etc.
Precisely. It's a really attractive model for some people now that the HSA compatibility is clear.
Those are some great evolving strategies. Any final implementation tips for successful stacking?
We mentioned the two-card system. If you're an employer offering dental and an LPFSA, consider auto-enrolling employees into a small LPFSA contribution just for dental premiums if they elect dental coverage. Makes it seamless. Clear communication is key for employees to understand how the different accounts work together.
Good tips. Okay, let's tackle another listener question. Someone's confused. My spouse has a traditional PPO plan through their work, and it comes with a general purpose FSA. I have an HSA eligible plan through my job. Can I still contribute to my HSA?
Ah, the spouse FSA question. This trips people up all the time. The general answer is likely no. You probably cannot contribute to your HSA in that situation.
Why not? It's the spouse's FSA.
Because a general purpose FSA, even if it belongs to your spouse, could potentially be used to reimburse your medical expenses before you meet your high deductible on your plan.
Even if they don't actually use it for me.
Just the ability for it to be used that way generally counts as disqualifying other health coverage under the HSA rules. It breaks that no coverage before the deductible rule.
Ouch. So the spouse's general purpose FSA can block my HSA contributions. What if it was a limited purpose FSA?
If the spouse only had a limited purpose FSA for dental vision, that would generally be okay. That wouldn't disqualify you. It's the general purpose nature that's usually a problem.
Important distinction. But wait, can I still use my existing HSA funds for my spouse's medical bills, even if their FSA blocks my contributions?
Yes, absolutely. You just can't add new money to your HSA while they have that general FSA coverage. But the money already in your HSA is fair game for qualified expenses for you, your spouse, or your dependents.
Okay, that's a relief. Contribution blocked, but reimbursement still okay. Got it. Next scenario from a listener. My spouse has a chronic condition, needs regular meds and doctor visits. Are we automatically better off with a traditional low deductible plan, even if it means giving up the HSA?
Not necessarily automatically. It requires doing the math.
Okay, what math?
You need to compare the total potential annual cost under both options. For the traditional plan, look at the higher premiums, plus copays, plus any coinsurance up to the out-of-pocket max.
Right.
For the QHDHP with HSA, look at the typically lower premiums, figure out the maximum out-of-pocket cost under that plan, and critically, factor in any employer contributions to the HSA and the tax savings you get on your own HSA contributions.
So compare total exposure, premiums plus max out-of-pocket, minus any employer HSA help and tax savings.
That's the core calculation. Yep. Also remember that many QHDHPs now cover certain preventive medications before the deductible, thanks to recent rules. That could significantly help someone with chronic conditions.
Good point about preventive meds.
And using tax-free HSA dollars to pay for those regular prescriptions is a big advantage. The HDHP still provides that catastrophic protection with its out-of-pocket maximum. Sometimes, even with chronic conditions, the HDHP-HSA combo comes out ahead financially, especially if the employer contributes generously to the HSA.
So don't assume. Run the numbers for your specific situation and plan options.
Exactly. And also keep an eye on how the Inflation Reduction Act might impact drug costs or manufacturer assistance programs, as that could shift the calculation too.
So much to consider. Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground today on these, you know, evolving ways to handle healthcare costs. If you had to boil it down, what's the single most important takeaway for listeners?
I think the key takeaway is that you really need to actively engage with these options now. Understanding HSAs, how they work, how they can be combined with other accounts. It's not just nice to know anymore.
It's essential.
It's essential for managing your costs effectively and honestly for building long-term financial security, especially thinking about healthcare and retirement. There are real aha moments waiting when you grasp the tax power and flexibility here.
I agree. Those tax advantages are hard to ignore once you see them clearly. So what's a final thought or question you'd leave people with?
Maybe just this. Take a serious look at your own situation. Which of these tools or strategies might actually fit your needs? And don't be afraid to dig into the details of what your employer offers. Ask yourself, could understanding this better fundamentally change how you spend and save for healthcare?
That's a great challenge. Could it shift your whole approach? If you want to dig deeper, definitely check out resources from your benefits administrator. Maybe look up some of those IRS notices we mentioned if you're feeling brave.
Or just reliable financial education websites.
Right. And hey, if you have questions about navigating this stuff, HSAs, FSAs, stacking, anything we talked about, send them our way. Your question might fuel a future deep dive.
Yeah, we'd love to hear them.
Ultimately, remember that taking control of your healthcare finances, it doesn't have to be this big, scary monster. Understanding these tools is a huge step towards feeling empowered.